Gill. Local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, it's Friday, and Dan Hoost, the communications director for Sullivan County Government, is here to tell us the latest in Monticello at the legislature, including a public health order that was amended and passed concerning vaccinations at local camps. Plus, Knit for Food Knit-a-thon 2024. It's a fundraiser for Feeding America, World Central Kitchen, No Kid Hungry, and Meals on Wheels. We'll talk to local knitter Leela McCullough about who's participating, about why it's important. And also, openings at the DVAA celebrating spring with paper pulp sculptures. Say that three times fast. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and for the release of hostages held by Hamas has failed. Russia and China voted against the resolution, and it cannot now be adopted. It had been supported by the U.S., whose diplomats had worked on the text for weeks. Previously, the U.S. has vetoed several calls for ceasefires in Gaza. Meanwhile, the European Union is calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza, as Terry Schultz reports from Brussels.
All 27 EU leaders are calling on Israel for a, quote, immediate humanitarian pause leading to a sustainable ceasefire, the unconditional release of all hostages, and the provision of humanitarian assistance. Recognizing Israel's right to defend itself, European Council President Charles Michel said more efforts must be made to ease the catastrophic situation in Gaza.
We believe in the international humanitarian law, and it's right that everything must be done to convince and to make sure that there is a real possibility for more humanitarian access.
EU leaders have also agreed to open membership negotiations with Bosnia-Herzegovina, which has been a candidate country since 2022, while it completed necessary reforms. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
The House of Representatives is meeting this morning to vote on a $1.2 trillion government funding package. If it passes, it moves to the Senate. Congress only has until midnight tonight to pass this, otherwise part of the federal government could shut down. The legislation would finance the federal government through the end of this fiscal year in September. New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez says he won't run for the Democratic nomination for his seat this fall. Menendez is facing several federal corruption charges. He's declared his innocence. Menendez is keeping the possibility open that he could run as an independent.
I will not file for the Democratic primary this June. I am hopeful that my exoneration will take place this summer and allow me to pursue my candidacy as an independent Democrat in the general election.
Menendez's wife, Nadine, and three other people have also been charged with corruption. Stocks opened modestly lower this morning after hitting record highs yesterday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped about 50 points in early trading.
Stock in FedEx is looking shiny after the company delivered better-than-expected quarterly profits. The FedEx board also authorized $5 billion worth of share buybacks. Nike stock was tripped up, however, as the sportswear giant warned of slower sales in the first half of the year. Reddit's new public offering took off like a meme stock Thursday, gaining 48% on the first day of trading. Company managers are trying to build a sustainable business after nearly two decades of losing money. Asian stocks were mixed overnight. Japan's Nikkei average briefly topped 41,000 for the first time, while shares were down in Hong Kong and Shanghai. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down more than 60 points. This is NPR. There are some presidential primary elections set tomorrow. Voters will go to the polls on Saturday in Louisiana, and Democrats in Missouri will also vote. Both President Biden and former President Donald Trump have already secured enough delegates to win their presidential nominations this summer at the Democratic and the Republican national conventions. The federal government and environmental groups are suing Campbell's Soup. They accuse the company of polluting one of the Great Lakes. NPR's Kristen Wright reports the Justice Department wants Campbell Soup to pay penalties.
The Environmental Protection Agency says wastewater containing pollutants from a Campbell Soup plant in Ohio flows into the Maumee River, then downstream into Lake Erie. The federal lawsuit alleges the company discharges illegally high levels of pollutants, including E. coli, phosphorus, and oil and grease into the water, in violation of the Clean Water Act. The EPA complaint points out that pollutants could threaten human health, plants, and wildlife. In a statement to NPR, a Campbell spokesperson says the company's working to resolve the issue permanently. Two environmental groups also filed a separate lawsuit. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
Police in Idaho have arrested an escaped prisoner and his accomplice, who helped him flee a hospital in Boise this week. Both are members of a white supremacist gang. Police say the accomplice shot two corrections officers this week. Idaho authorities also say they're investigating two separate homicides that may potentially be linked to the prisoner's escape. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include PBS with The Cancer Detectives, American Experience with the little-known story of the early war on cancer, premiering Tuesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and this music indicates it is Friday, and Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government is here.
Another dramatic entrance. My goodness, I'm spoiled here.
It's actually just me forgetting to pot down NPR. But welcome, Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. Happy Friday.
To you as well. Hey, I always like to start with a little bit of humor, intentional or otherwise.
Let's talk about what's going on at the legislature in Monticello, meeting yesterday. Also, there was an emergency meeting on Wednesday, is that right, about this public health order?
Right. Yep, the legislators met with camp operators who had concerns about the original wording of the public health order, and so they came to a compromise that was basically realized yesterday during the morning meeting of the recessed meeting of the Health and Human Services Committee, where instead of having this vaccination order apply to all the staff of the camps in addition to all the children of the camps, it now applies just to all the children, not the staff.
So let's remind folks again what this order was. We talked about it last week, but just for folks who may not have heard, the legislature was considering this public health order concerning vaccinations at local summer camps.
Yes. In years past, the legislature, as the Public Health Board of Sullivan County, a lot of people don't realize that it actually has that authority vested in it by the state. It's not our public health department. It's the legislators themselves because they're elected. And so they've in the past put what we always colloquially knew as the measles order, which was just basically ensuring the children of the camps in Sullivan County, secular and religious, this applies to all, it's not targeting one group, had all their appropriate vaccinations, because camps can be super spreader areas where the kids are all in close proximity to one another. They're usually playing together. They're in bunk bed areas together, dormitories together. They're eating together. So there's a lot of close contact. And anyone who has kids knows they easily spread germs. So this is just for the health, safety, and welfare, not only of the campers, but of the public at large. Because if there's some sort of super spreader event that happens at these camps, that could easily get out into the community. The bone of contention this year was whether staff should be forced to prove their vaccination as well. And camp operators put forth, some of the camp operators put forth the idea, well, you know, we don't require this of other places where children congregate for the staff to all be vaccinated. And legislators were divided on that. Mm-hmm. Some of the legislators felt that it should be all the people who are daily on the campgrounds. Other legislators were like, yeah, but what if the delivery guy came by and gave it? You can't account for that. So it was a back and forth, and I'm not going to come down on either side, and I'm just trying to explain how it was debated out. And the eventual consensus was a compromise, as it is on a lot of times in these controversial issues, of we're going to enforce this for all the kids of the camp, most of whom are already coming vaccinated because they have to get them when they go to school. but not for staff. Of course, our public health department wanted the entire part of that to include staff, but they're okay with this, and they're just going to monitor closely. The Department of Health regulates these camps, and we've worked with them before when there were potential outbreaks. I don't remember anything too recent being a huge outbreak. I think we had a pertussis issue last year.
There's CDC issued some guidance to doctors this week about an increase in measles, an outbreak that's happening. In fact, the number of measles cases in the U.S. currently equals the total for last year. So there is some concern there.
There's definitely concern. And you called it the measles, I was talking about Sullivan County.
Well, I know, but you called it the measles rule, and so this is certainly
out there, that's part of something
to talk about and to consider.
And our public health department has to have that at the forefront of their mind.
Right.
So, but I think they feel that, you know, this is better than nothing. Last year, nothing got passed. This order wasn't even in place when it had been in years past. So,
how did the local summer camp operators react? And you said there was a compromise, so that input was taken into account in coming up with this order.
Yeah, there were. I can't speak for any of the camp operators, and I can't even say that the majority of them necessarily were involved in this discussion, but there was a significant amount that came out Wednesday and even then came out yesterday to observe and comment on the proceedings, and they seemed to walk away satisfied with it. I wasn't hearing from any of them that they were against kids being vaccinated that they have in their camps. Didn't hear that at all.
When does this go into effect, and how is it enforced?
It goes into effect basically now. It goes through till the end of December. It's enforced really through the State Department of Health, even though it's a county rule. The state has jurisdiction over these camps. The public health department, though, is empowered through this to be part of that process. We would be anyway, but I think there's just a degree of more authority now that they have. Certainly to monitor and report and react if necessary to this, because one of the key things to do is to stop an outbreak before it has the chance to become an outbreak. So if you have something very contagious that's starting to get passed around in a congregate setting like a camp, our public health team wants to swoop in fast and get those folks isolated. Make sure that they're vaccinated, they're up to date, and the people who have to be around them are also vaccinated and up to date on their shots. So I've seen them in action before on this. We drill for this every year. We have a practice for this every year. Sometimes we do it, it's a tabletop drill where we sort of do it on paper, email, that kind of thing. Sometimes we actually do it in person where we have an in-person meeting like we've had it at the college before, where we actually plan for, we make this a simulation. There we go. That's the word I'm looking for. I'm involved with that because I'm the official state designated, actually, public health information officer for Sullivan County. Yes. So if there is a contagious disease outbreak, I need to know all the steps I need to take to inform the public and ensure that that education leads to their safety.
I was going to say that, you know, with the large number of summer camps in our area, it's not something that the county is not used to dealing with.
Right.
In fact, to know that you drill on this is good to hear, and you're prepared, and the county's prepared for the students and kids that are coming in as they do every summer.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's talk about health rankings while we're on the subject of health. Sullivan County, bless you. Sullivan County. We have a cough button, but not a sneeze button.
I pushed it. It still carried, didn't it?
The latest health rankings, unofficially, but putting Sullivan County a little higher up in the rankings, not as far down as we had been. Notoriously, it has been, Sullivan County's been down to 61 or 60 or 62, even out of the 62 counties in New York for health rankings. It looks like there's a significant jump. So let folks know where.
Yeah, our Commissioner of Health and Human Services, John Little, who is rightfully excited about this news, even though, I mean, we're not number one in New York State, but by his calculations, we have gone up several notches. We were, I think, last time about in 60, 61 out of 62 counties. Now we're at 57 by his calculations. However, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which puts these numbers out, is no longer ranking it that way. They're ranking us on a national basis. Mm-hmm. And according to what John found out, told me in the legislature yesterday, Sullivan County rated in the top half of counties nationwide for health outcomes, which are length of life and quality of life ratings. So we are making progress. Now, this data, too, is about 2 years old that they drew from, because it takes them a while to get to it. So it's no more recent than 2021, maybe 2022. So that's just as we're coming out of the pandemic. If it's going in that direction, we're fairly optimistic, and at the very least, very hopeful, that next year and the year after that, we're going to continue to see increases, because we've been putting a lot of initiatives into place.
I was going to say, a lot of resources since then behind this. Yep. And to remind folks, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation County Health Rankings is a report of key health measures such as high school graduation rates, obesity, smoking, unemployment, teen birth. It's a snapshot of how health is influenced by where folks live and learn and play.
Yep.
So that's good to hear that, you know, with data that's the latest data, but is a couple of years old, knowing that the county and other stakeholders have been putting a lot more resources, a lot more effort into this, that there's some positive signs, some benefit.
Well, and we have a new partner since that time, actually, in Sullivan 180, mm-hmm. which has been working with us. That's really their goal now. And so we're going to be putting out a press release later today with them talking about how excited they're about this information as well, because we really do feel like we can only go up from here. There are, of course, challenges that remain. There's never going to be a day when I say, well, our work is done.
Yeah.
Right. You know, we have the access to primary care providers. They're reducing the number of preventable hospital stays, injury deaths, which include auto accidents, but also substance use and suicide. We have issues that we have to address there. Certainly one that is concerning a lot of people. The legislature is working on right now is our ambulances, mm-hmm. The service, our EMS service, response times, having adequate crews, making sure that people aren't waiting an inordinately long amount of time for an ambulance to reach them and transport them to where they need to go. So there are a lot of challenges still to work on, but it's good, especially for the morale of our healthcare workers, to say, hey, we're making progress. We're ticking up in the rankings, and I want to give a shout out to all of them, those that are on the county's team directly and those that we work with, like Sullivan 180 and Garnet and Crystal Run. We're making a difference.
There's a psychological boost there, knowing
absolutely
that some of the work that's being done is having some result. Yesterday at the legislature, the independent audit showing that the county is on an upward trend financially. Explain.
Yes. This is not the full audit that will be done in June, which I'll have more to talk about then. But what they were seeing in terms of the latest data was that we continue to be in a healthy fiscal situation. One of the things that they really use to gauge that is our fund balance, which is basically, for lack of a better word, the surplus. And of course, a taxpayer might say, hey, why are you just hoarding my money, keeping it to the side? Well, there are plenty of things that come along, not least of which from the state and the federal government, these unfunded mandates that we have to find money for. So if we don't keep money in reserve, you're going to see a tax increase much sooner rather than later. And it could be a much higher tax increase than otherwise. So our fund balance has increased to 25% compared to our total general fund expenditures. So in other words, we are making sure that more money is coming in and staying in that is going out. And that translates to what we've had in the past few years, which have been either zero or very small county tax increases. And depending on how your equalization rate works in your town, sometimes it becomes a tax decrease as well. Now, unfortunately, your county tax bill is one of the smallest portions of the property taxes that you pay every year. But listen, every little dollar counts. And I can really say, and the auditors have pointed this out as well, that your elected and appointed officials that handle the money that you have to give every year are doing it as responsibly and accountably as they can, in a general grand sense. Now, everyone has different opinions on what we should be spending the money on. And, you know, there might be a pothole here or a bridge there that you're like, hey, we should focus on that. We're not. I'm not getting into that kind of nitty gritty detail. That's for folks to come to our legislative meetings and tell their legislators how they feel.
Oh, you tease.
But overall, it shows that we are being responsible according to generally accepted accounting principles with taxpayers' money. And that's really the most for what you could ask for any government, short of it to, you know, happen at no cost to anybody. But how often does that work?
Give you money back. You're just joining us. We're speaking to Dan Hoost. He's communications director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday with an update from the legislature. We'll take a quick break and get to more right after this. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Winter hours online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving four counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Hi there, this is Brian, host of The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9. I'll be playing a mix of indie, alternative, college, rock, and pop. Some new music and some old classics. That's The Secret Show, Friday nights at 9, only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It's Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, joined by Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government. We're talking about what's going on at the legislature in Monticello, and the 2023 annual report is out.
Yes.
What is in that?
Well, this is required by the county's code, which is basically its rules that the legislature and the administrative team have to follow. And the county manager, Josh Potosik, as the top appointed leader of the county, is required to give an annual report as soon as practicable after the end of the fiscal year, which we have a calendar fiscal year, so it ended December 31st, to give this report to the legislature about what basically all the departments and offices in the county have done in 2023 for this particular report, but in the past year. And we also include a little bit of what their goals may be for the future years, although it really does focus on the past fiscal year. So the annual report, I put it together because that's part of my job. I work for the county manager right in his office. So it's about a 200-page document, so it takes a few months for us to get it all together. But once it's put together, you have a marvelous view of a 10,000-foot view, not necessarily every little detail, but a marvelous view of what all the county offices and departments are up to. And we make that available to the public. Last night, I put it up on the website. It is available anywhere you go under the helpful links. Just click on 2023 Annual Sullivan County Report. It's a large document, so it may take a little bit of time to download, but it is really worth your time. I learned so much from reading it. Sure, there are things that you might skip over that aren't particularly of interest to you, but we have, it's what we have a table of contents for, so that you can go see what you're looking at. But it also is a point of pride for each of our offices to say, hey, look what we've done for the taxpayer. And it's really interesting to see all the work that has gone on in 2023. There's a reason that I titled this year's annual report Shining Brightly, because our team really has been shining brightly. I know government tends to get knocked around a lot, and I get it. There are things that we can do better always, but there are things that we're doing really well, and people should know about that, especially the people who pay, whether they want to or not, for those services. So it's really interesting if you take a look at it. Like I said, you don't have to read all 200 pages, but just browse through some of it, and you will be, I'm quite sure, impressed by the breadth and depth of services we offer.
Also, the Charter Review Commission report, what is that? And there's a new commission? What does the Charter Review Commission do?
I wanted to explain this to folks because yesterday the legislature heard from the former Charter Review Commission. And the charter is the county's founding document, sort of like its version of the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is what created the legislature back in 1995. And since that time, every 10 years, the charter requires a group of local folks selected by the legislature to come together, the Charter Review Commission, to review the charter and make recommendations, if any, to legislators for changes or updates to that charter so that it remains a living document, yep. not something that just this is how it's always been. So legislators this year have to appoint a new charter review commission to be able to start meeting the deadlines they'll have to next year, because that'll be the 10-year mark for since the last charter review commission started meeting. Because if the charter started the process, the time ticking in 1995, so then we had one in 2005, then we had one in 2015. Well, surprisingly enough, as old as I feel saying this, it's 2025 next year. So
can you believe?
And so we'll have to have a commission in place. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to hear, especially since this is a majority new legislature, from the past Charter Review Commission and what they had recommended. The things that they had recommended were staggered terms for legislators, meaning not all legislators run at the same time. Currently they do. All nine positions are up for election at the same mm-hmm. time. So staggered terms was what they recommended, and they also recommended a county executive, or at least putting it on a public referendum for a county executive who would be elected by the people rather than a county manager who is appointed by the legislature, which is elected by the people. So there was discussion about that, and the former Charter Review Commission wants them, at least with the county executive, to go ahead and implement their recommendations now. Those recommendations date back to 2017, so there's going to be debate amongst legislators whether they should go ahead now or should wait for the next Charter Review Commission to come back and make recommendations to the legislature on their own.
So the county executive issue may not be brought up in this term, or they'll discuss it?
It could. I mean, right now, we're getting close to a majority. There may even be a majority of legislators who decide to put it on the November ballot for voters to say, yes, I want the legislature to start transitioning us to a county executive form of government, or no, mm-hmm. I don't want them to. And so there's discussion further about that. There are a lot of things to talk about with county executive. This is not just something where voters say yes and magically it happens.
Yeah, I mean, in other counties, there are county executives. It comes to mind, like Ulster has a county executive. Are there advantages to a county executive versus – is it just a matter of who's appointing the person, who's electing the person?
Well, I think this is much more than we'd have time for now, but there are definitely pros and cons on both sides. I've studied it closely, and there's, I believe, 18 counties in New York State that have a county executive out of 62. However, the chartered counties like we are, there are only five chartered counties like us that don't have a county executive. Like Delaware County, for example, they don't even have a charter. They're still with the Board of Supervisors, which we transition from. Ulster, Orange, Rockland, Westchester have a county executive. The arguments for include more visibility and thus potentially more impact and sway at the state level. That it's a person elected by the public rather than appointed by the legislature. On the con side of it, that it will come with more expenses and another layer of government. There is debate about that, but from my research, I think it's inevitable that there would be more cost to it. I also heard the thing of, where does that leave the legislature? Are they still as powerful as they are now, or are they disempowered with it? On the other hand, with the county executive, could they actually get things done maybe more quickly and more authoritatively and promptly than a legislature? Probably so. Mm. So there's a lot to talk about, and legislators may decide how they want to proceed on their own, or they may decide to put it up to a public vote. I would say the alternative will be is either that legislators majority decide we're not going to go forward with this at this time, or they decide we're going to put it out to a public vote in November. That's basically what it boils down to, those two choices.
Right.
And they are going to be discussing it further. So this is another real reason for people to tune into these legislative meetings, to attend these meetings, and let their legislators know how they feel, pro or con, because this is how you will be governed in the future, potentially.
Yeah, we'll keep talking about it. We'll keep checking in with you. Maybe we'll even have Dan, who's the county executive edition special. Special in-depth 1 hour. All right, let's get to some other things before we have to go. Some reminders. Early voting starts tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. It does. And it starts in two locations tomorrow. We have, this is for the presidential primary, which is going to be April 2nd. but we're going to have early voting for that for registered Democrats and registered Republicans who can vote in Sullivan County starting tomorrow, March 23rd, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., a long amount of time for people to come in. So a very, very convenient, very generous time given there at both the Government Center in Monticello and our Public Health or Gladys Olmsted building, which is 50 Community Lane in Liberty. And Sunday, then, we will continue from 9 to 6. Monday, the 25th, it will be 8 to 5. Tuesday, the 26th, 11 to 8. Wednesday, the 27th, 8 to 5. Thursday, the 28th, 11 to 8. And then Friday, the 29th, 8 to 5. And Saturday, the 30th, 9 to 6. There will not be any early voting on Sunday, the 31st. Typically, when we have early voting, we do have that final Sunday before the actual election, but not this year.
That's Easter Sunday.
Yes.
And so early voting at those two locations, you could check that off your list and vote beginning tomorrow.
Yep.
All right. Burn ban, in effect, started on the 14th and goes...
Started on the
16th. Goes through the 14th of May.
It goes through the 14th of May. It is in effect now. Please do not burn anything outside. No matter how wet the ground seems to you, it doesn't mean that our plants are full of water or whatever juices plants are full of, sap, that kind of thing. They are still very dry because of the nature of the growth cycle and the seasons. So we've already had some brush fires in the area that our firefighters have had to put out. Don't let it happen to your property because it might burn up a lot more than just the grass that you have. It could actually affect your property or, goodness gracious, even injure or kill someone.
Yeah, it's every year. Let's let nature do its thing and not hurt it. Burn ban in effect. Let's also remind folks that emergency heap assistance available, but folks have to apply for that. How can they apply and what are some of the parameters there?
Yeah, we have this. It's not something that happens automatically. We've had folks asking me about that. Well, I already applied and got the regular heap benefit. Don't I get the emergency heap benefit automatically? No, because you need to be telling the state, I need this because I'm about to run out of fuel. Whether it's wood or pellets or fuel oil or propane or kerosene, the state basically covers everything, and you can get several hundred dollars worth of fuel to keep you from running out towards the very end of the season. That's why they call this emergency heap. If you were eligible for the regular heap benefit, you're very likely eligible for this as well, but more people than not may actually be eligible. You may not realize, and I encourage everybody to give a call just to find out whether you're eligible at our HEAP office, 845-807-0142. That's 807-0142. And they can help guide you on how to apply and make sure that you get the benefit that you may very desperately need.
The state is issuing some broadband maps, and the public is invited to comment on those. What's going on
Yes,
there?
I was hoping to have the press release out before I came this morning. So it's going to be later today that I'm going to have information because there's a way to do it, and I don't really want to explain it over the radio. It's easier to see. But we're going to have something where you will be able to weigh in on the State Public Service Commission's look at broadband coverage in all of New York State, but specific to your community. They want to know, are the maps that we have currently accurate? And we already know that they aren't. How could they be?
Right.
But we've been working over the past few years to make sure that they're more accurate and the public can help us with that.
We'll talk more about that next week once you get that press release out. Okay.
I'll have more, but keep an eye out for it.
There's a performance at the County Museum April 7th. Jazz guitarist and composer Paul Kogut.
Paul Kogut, yes, is coming. It'll be at 2 p.m. On the 7th at the County Museum. This is part of the First Sunday concerts that Aldo and Carol Troiani put on at the County Museum. They just make that place shine, and it has become a venue that I never expected it would be. It's not just a museum now. It's, they've got this gymnatorium. It's a former school where they have these wonderful, very intimate concerts from very, very accomplished people, mm-hmm. people who are world-class musicians and vocalists. I've been to several of these. It's just fun not only to go and listen because it's free, but also to mix and mingle with people that you probably wouldn't otherwise. And then you can go take a look at all the fascinating thousands upon thousands of historical items from Sullivan County. My recent visit there, I found out there was this surveyor's tool. I forget. It's not a sextant. It's there's something they call it. But John Jones, who was one of the founders of Monticello, used to survey the village of Monticello when it was first created 200 years ago. We've got that in the collection.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So,
and before we go, briefly, but want to recognize the Liberty Police Department, who were recognized with an accreditation.
Yes, yes. This is a very difficult accreditation to get from the New York State Division of Criminal Justice Services. And it basically says that you're adhering to a very high level of performance and integrity in how you carry out your duties. Not just the chief, who was honored yesterday by the legislature, Steve DeGatta, who's a great guy, but also the entire department. They have to be hitting a very high bar to reach this. They have never actually reached this level before of accreditation, and now they've got it. It is a significant achievement, and the legislature was very proud of them and wanted to acknowledge them in public yesterday. So congratulations to the Liberty PD. You have earned quite an honor.
Congratulations to them. Thank you, Dan Hoost from Sullivan County Government, joining us every Friday with news from Monticello. Lots of good news today, too. So thank you.
Yeah.
All right. We'll take a break. And when we come back, more details on a knit-a-thon to help those in need of food, food insecure. That's coming up next, right after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
This week on Science Friday, studying the magic motion of a swimming sea lion.
They pull themselves through the water with this big clapping motion.
Plus the tense moments in a mission to sample an asteroid.
It was an amazing journey to a world that nobody had ever been to before.
That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Today, from 2 to 4 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Knit for Food Knit-a-thon is a fundraiser for Feeding America, World Central Kitchen, No Kid Hungry, and Meals on Wheels. Joining us now is Leela McCullough, who owns Woolworth, a store in Calicoon specializing in breed-specific local yarns from the region, knitting tools, and more. Leela, good morning.
Good morning, Tim.
So,
Knit-a-thon. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, thanks for being here, and thanks for telling us about Knit for Food, the Knit-a-thon. I hadn't heard about this. What is it? Did I describe it correctly? And what is it? Is it kind of like a dance-a-thon? You're doing this for hours?
Yes. From tomorrow, from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., I will be knitting straight through, and it is like when you sponsor a runner in a marathon, you could sponsor me to knit for the day, and there are knitters all over the country knitting all day tomorrow for this cause.
Wow. How did you get involved?
It's a pretty big deal in the knitting community, and so I saw it through my friend's page, Beetle and Fred, over in Beacon. She's doing it as well. And we just are all joining together to raise money for this cause. They've been doing this for the past 3 years, and they've raised in the neighborhood of $300,000. And this is my first year participating, but we're hoping to do even better this year.
Wow, that's amazing. I'm just looking at the website here, and they're, you know, last year raised $340,000 with your knitting needles. That is amazing.
Yeah, it's great when we come together to do something big.
You mentioned the knitting community. it is really a community of folks, right? And something, you know, banding together for something like this, food insecurity, that's gotta be even more special. Talk a little bit about the kind of unique nature of the knitting community.
Well, there's people all over the world. We mostly are, I think, focused on Ravelry, which is a social network for knitters and crocheters and weavers, and Instagram, and there are celebrities within the knitting community, like in any group of people. And
like you locally.
Oh, locally, sure. yeah, and it's really great that we have the internet now to bring us together from all over the world, rather than just the local group of people, which is great too. And we do have a great local group of knitters.
So how does it feel for you to participate in something like this with your friends in the knitting community and doing something that's raising funds and awareness for something that's so meaningful, food insecurity?
Oh, it's fantastic. I don't really know offhand of another knitting cause like this, where everybody comes together to raise money for one thing. There's, of course, lots of other small causes, and Woolworth has participated in the past with Dress a Girl Around the World and Knitted Knockers, and we make things to donate, but this is more about raising funds for people outside the community.
So I'm looking at the website, which is the fundraising page at givebutter.com, which is Knit for Food 24. Over $267,000 already raised. The goal is $341,000, so you're at 78% of the goal. You mentioned that you'll be doing this tomorrow, and folks wanted to sponsor you. How could they do that?
They can go to givebutter.com/knitforfood24/ Leila, L-E-I-L-A, McCullough, M-C-C-U-L-L-O-U-G-H. Or they can come to my store and I'll have a QR that they could just scan and go straight to that page. And we'll have some chairs set up in my store tomorrow from 12 to 5, and I'll be there knitting. And anyone who wants to join me to knit is welcome to come, or crochet, or whatever anybody wants to do. And if we run out of space in my store, because it is very small, we have overflow set up at Rafter's Tavern across the street. And there's going to be a Zoom meeting going on with a lot of people around the world who are doing this knit-a-thon. And we'll have that playing both at Woolworth and at Rafter's Tavern.
And the Knit for Food Knit-a-thon, 100% of the funds raised are donated. They go to Feeding America, the World Central Kitchen, No Kid Hungry, and Meals on Wheels. So it's just amazing that you guys are getting together and doing this. What are you knitting? Do you have a specific thing that you are you required to knit, or do you come up with something? And what do you do for 12 hours of knitting?
Well, I don't think it's going to take all 12 hours, but for at least a portion of the time, I'm going to be knitting a Sophie scarf, which is a small neck scarf, and I'll do a random drawing for one person who donates to my specific campaign to give it away to somebody who donates any amount. You could donate 10 cents and you'll be entered in the drawing.
All right. So the Knit for Food Knit-a-thon, it's happening tomorrow from 10 to 10. Leila McCullough of Woolworth in Calicoon is participating, and you could sponsor someone locally to help raise money for folks who are food insecure. 100% of funds raised will be equally divided between Feeding America, World Central Kitchen, No Kid Hungry, and Meals on Wheels. There's more information at givebutter.com /knitforfood24, and more information about Leila and Woolworth at wool-worth.com. Leila, thanks so much for joining us. We'll let you go and rest your hands.
Thank you, Tim. I will hopefully see you tomorrow.
We'll stop by. All right. We'll take a quick... Yeah, thank you. We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, two receptions at the DVAA tomorrow. We'll hear from two of those artists, from culture reporter Valerie Manzi, next. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I'm Scott Detrow. Each week on All Things Considered from NPR, we'll get you caught up on the latest from former President Trump's legal challenges. Join us every Saturday.
On Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. There are two opening receptions at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance tomorrow from 4 to 6. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to those two artists, Candace Gierbach and Warren Party. First, Candace Gierbach is from Keshekton, and she brings her exhibition Anxious Nature to the Alliance Gallery, featuring a whimsical array of paper pulp sculptures inspired by the vibrant colors of spring. Here's Valerie Manzi.
Good morning, Cadence, and welcome to Radio Catskill.
Thanks so much, Valerie. Nice to be here.
So you have an opening coming up at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance in Narrowsburg entitled Anxious Nature, and there's a reception on March 23rd and an artist talk on April 13th. And for more information, folks can go to the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance website. Tell us about Anxious Nature.
Sure. So the show has a combination of paintings and sculptures that I've been making over the past several years. And the project started actually during the pandemic when I was up here a whole lot and spending a tremendous amount of time in my garden and trying to cultivate this very rough area.
Oh, yes.
You
yes.
know how it is, fighting all the elements, moving rocks around, fighting off the deer, trying to prevent them from eating everything. So the work really grew out of that experience. So it was really important for me to be able to show it up here in this place that was sort of the genesis of the project.
What was the kernel of the creative process?
Well, just digging in the earth and looking at the sky and looking at the plants and all the creatures and really feeling very immersed in the landscape in a very visceral way, getting dirty in the landscape. And that was very different from work that I had done previously, which was really about standing back from the landscape and looking at it from a distance, seeing it more as a vista.
Now, did the medium you used change as a result?
Well, it did, mostly because of the pandemic, I had very little access to materials. So before I was making work in ceramics and painting on panels, small panels. But during the pandemic, I didn't have access to a kiln, so I couldn't do ceramics and I didn't have the panels. So I did two things. I went to Walmart and I bought a bolt of fabric. And I started painting these large paintings on fabric with no stretchers at all. And those are in the show. And I also started working in paper mache. So there's a lot of actually it's more paper pulp is what it is. But the first piece I made up here during the pandemic was literally two balloons, some strips of newspaper and flour and water. And it's grown since then significantly.
So it was just what you had available.
Exactly. Yep.
What scale are some of these sculptures paintings?
So the scale varies. I have some small pieces that are maybe, I don't know, less than 20 inches, and then a couple of larger ones. In the center of the room are two large stones, like boulder-sized stones, that I made recently for a dance performance in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm showing them again. I've cleaned them up since the dance performance. Like, we're all moved around and roughed up, but they're there. And there's also something I'm calling Ghost House, which is a birdhouse that I made. It's shaped like this house that I live in Coshecton. And inside the house are mice and birds that are painted black with stars on them. And those are actually, it's actually a memorial to all of the creatures that came into our house and sadly didn't make it out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. We honor all beings.
Yes.
Now, you have a website where folks can see some of your work, and I did see some photographs of that dance performance you did pieces for. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us what your website is?
Sure. It's my name. It's cadencegiersbach.com.
And how do we spell Giersbach?
Giersbach is G-I-E-R-S. B-A-C-H.
Is there anything else you would like to add before we conclude?
No, I hope everybody comes and sees the work.
Hey, and the artist talk, too.
Oh, yeah, there's an artist talk on the 13th, so yes. Please come.
Thank you, Cadence, and that's Anxious Nature, which opens at DVAA on March 23rd and runs through April 28th.
And my apologies to Cadence for mispronouncing your name in the introduction to that segment. That is tomorrow, as Valerie Manzi said. The other exhibition tomorrow is in the Loft Gallery at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. It's Warren Pardee from Berryville presenting the Curvilinear Form, a collection of sculptural furniture and objects full of bends, twists, and turns. Cultural reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to Warren Pardee.
Good morning, Warren, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning to you, too. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes, well, we're going to talk about your exhibit that opens at Delaware Valley Arts Alliance this Saturday, March 23rd, and runs through April 24th, and it is entitled The Curvilinear Form. What is this exhibit about?
My exhibit is about a number of works that I've done over the last few years in a curvilinear form rather than linear dimension, or a combination of both linear and curvilinear interacting with each other.
And what is the material?
Working in wood. I do furniture, which is functional. So the form is curvilinear, basically, but the functional part has a linear aspect to it.
Meaning?
Meaning that curvilinear is a form that could be anything from working with curve to just ribbon-like structures. Techniques is that you cut the wood in thin strips and then bend it in a form in various ways and put it together. Glue it, put it together, and you have a curvilinear form. And, for instance, one of my chairs where you would have to sit would be linear. So that would be a traditional type of form where you have mortar tendon joints, dowels, and so on, whereas the curvilinear aspects of my work are really not functional, but express meaning, and the techniques are different in the way it's put together.
Okay. And
I'm not sure if that answers your question. But.
Well, it's getting us there, yes. Will you have furniture on display and other items as well?
Yes, I'll have furniture. I have two chair designs, and I have coffee tables and an end table, which I call Stars in My Eyes, and I have a number of keepsake boxes and turned items, turned bowls.
I noticed in looking at your website, which is a party, P-A-R-D-I, designs.com, mm-hmm. that a number of your pieces have references to nature. Waves and stars and blades of grass and flowing brook.
Well, all of my pieces are referenced to nature and really the way I feel that nature works. Actually, I'm a scientist at heart. I'm a scientist who failed at math, basically. So I look at nature in different components. So everything I do really is some aspect of nature which I'm trying to express. The unpredictability of nature, the way the curvilinear form. I do functional furniture, but in that function are the randomness of nature. The curvilinear expresses the randomness, and the linear expresses the sort of the end point of that randomness, and it all comes together in a functional piece. But all has to do with nature. I have boxes that are called flowing brook. So my boxes are shaped as stones, and they have a triple veneer that runs across the top, which represents water flowing over a hard object and how it softens it down into a really nice functional piece. So, so my pieces express some aspect about nature.
And what drew you to working with wood in the first place?
All right. I never expected to work in wood. I came about it in a curvilinear way, I guess.
Okay.
I was actually working as a social worker after college, and I started to make large Indian print pillows during the 70s. And in those days, instead of buying furniture, they would sit on these huge pillows. So I started making them, and I was selling them in Greenwich Village. And people started asking me if I could make platforms for the pillows. So I said, sure. So I tried to make platforms of my own design. I really got to appreciate, as I was sanding wood and carving it to make the platforms, I got to really appreciate the way the grain flowed in these pieces. That started me really to think about the curvilinear forms. Having a philosophical bent to begin with, I had an epiphany about nature and the way it flows in wood. And that started me really to think about making pieces that were curved. And
your work will also be exhibited with another artist whose exhibit is called Anxious Nature. So both of the exhibits are tied to nature.
I didn't realize that. I read about her exhibit and met her. Yeah, it is interesting. We both have exhibits that really express the beauty of nature and some aspect of it.
And both using very different materials. So you'll also be having a talk about your work on April 20th at Delaware Valley Arts Alliance. And folks can get more information about that and the exhibit and much more at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we end?
No, I think that's that sums everything up.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking the time out of your creative process to share that process with us.
Thank you very much.
And that's culture reporter Valerie Manzi speaking to Warren Purdy, who, along with Cadence Giersbach, is opening tomorrow at the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance two exhibits, one in the Alliance Gallery, the other in the Loft Gallery. There's more information at DelawareValleyArtsAlliance.org. And that'll do it for us for Radio Chatskill. On Monday, our intern student reporter Laying Tang sat down with Wendy Townsend. She's a local writer and iguana specialist, deeply passionate about lizards and committed to their conservation. We'll have that interview Monday on Radio Chatskill at 10. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Radio Chatskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
You're on the go, and Radio Catskill can go with you. Listen live to Radio Catskill on your phone.
Just type WJFFradio.org into your browser and listen wherever you are. Stay up to date on local news, culture, and NPR on the go on your phone with Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. On Point is coming up next. A winter weather advisory goes into effect at 8 this evening through 2 tomorrow, expecting mixed precipitation and total snow accumulations of 1 to 3 inches, and the possibility of ice accumulations up to 1/10 of an inch. This is for Delaware, Sullivan, and Otsego counties in New York. Plan on slippery road conditions, a wintry mix of snow, sleet, and freezing rain developing this evening, changing mainly to rain Saturday morning. And that freezing rain will hold on longest at elevations greater than 2,000 feet. Slow down and use caution while traveling to check the latest road conditions for the state you're calling from or traveling in can be obtained by calling 511. We're looking at a high of 34 today and then a low of 29 tonight. WJFF Jeffersonville, W233 AH Monticello, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. It's 11 o'clock.